There is no regulating body to the martial arts industry. It doesn't exist. Anybody can just open up a martial arts school with no credentials whatsoever, call themselves the 75th degree black belt of the universe, of their own style they made up, and without any real experience, open up a school and take advantage of people.
So guys, today is the 10th episode of the Jiu-Jitsu Jabber podcast. So a nice little milestone there for us. And we're celebrating in style by having a special celebrity on. Our guest today has been training in martial arts for over 2 decades. He's a third degree black belt in karate, a purple belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. He is a third degree black belt in Lisa Judo, but frankly is probably best known for his history of calling out the bad guys. With almost 500,000 Instagram followers now, as well as very healthy YouTube following, ladies and gentlemen, McDojo Life in the Flesh, Mr. Rob Ingram. Hi, Rob. Welcome to the podcast.
What's up, man? Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. I love talking shop.
I really appreciate you making time for our little podcast. I know you're very busy. Just sort of jumping right into a topic I think of interest to most people. When did you first start finding an interest in these fake martial arts that exist?
Well, I mean, I guess, you know, as a kid, when you're growing up, you see all these different martial arts films and shows where they're doing these mystical things and these mystical abilities that are kind of piggybacking off of martial arts. Like if you watch Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and they're floating across rooftops and making the wind create this leaf tornado that they shoot at people. So, I mean, as a kid, you're always seeing stuff like that, but you know, I guess somewhere along the line, you realize that that's just fantasy. Like, that's not real. Unfortunately, there's a lot of people in the world that don't think that that's fantasy, that do believe that you can do things like that. And as crazy as that sounds, they exist. But I started McDojo Life because of a conversation that I had with a student. So I had a student who was at the martial arts facility I was teaching at. I was a striking coach, and I ran their kids' jiu-jitsu program. But I also was a program director there, which was my main job. So I was in there. I was working on some paperwork that day. The lead instructor, the owner, wasn't able to make it in. He called in sick and asked if I would be able to go in and teach the class for him. I said, no problem. Taught the class as soon as it was over. Everybody for the noon class anyway was either having to go right back to work or they had nothing else to do. And so they would hang out and we'd talk and we'd have conversations. And that day we had a conversation about fake martial arts, about McDojos. And as we were having the conversation, there was a student there. It was only his second class ever in any martial art whatsoever. And then everyone left and he stayed behind for a second. And he said, hey, man, I'm a little embarrassed. You guys were talking about McDojos. He goes, I don't know exactly what that is. Could you kind of explain it to me? And I was like, yeah, not a problem. So I gave him what is now the basis of the whole rules of the page. And he asked me a very simple question. He said, why doesn't anybody do anything about that? And I thought, man, that's a really good question.
Yeah,
because there is no regulating body to the martial arts industry. It doesn't exist. Anybody can just open up a martial arts school with no credentials whatsoever, call themselves the 75th degree black belt of the universe, of their own style they made up, and without any real experience, open up a school and take advantage of people. And so the next day I started McDojo Life. The truth is I don't think that there should be a regulating body, but I do think that we should self-regulate better. And the only real way to do that without having someone come in and being this all-encompassing like entity that will eventually turn corrupt and take advantage of everybody underneath in the system is self-governing. And if you're able to spread the information, you're able to spread that out to the world, more people are going to recognize things that are BS. They're going to recognize, oh, right, that's familiar. I've seen this person on this being discussed on this channel, this page by these people that I respect. It's nonsense. So do I want to join that? Will that help me reach my individual goals? And the old version of what people call the McDojo is so subjective, it's almost nonsensical. And all it does is hurt the industry. Because the old standard of what a McDojo was referred to was like a McDonald's. That standard is a nonsensical standard. How long it takes somebody to get a black belt is going to be different from art to art to art to art. Mm-hmm. And so you'll have people complain. They'll be like, oh, he got his black belt in like 2 years in Taekwondo. Yeah, but BJ Penn got his black belt in jiu-jitsu in like 3. They'll be like, well, he's BJ Penn and it's jiu-jitsu. So your problem isn't how long it took to get the black belt. Your problem is the art. Or your problem is that you don't feel these people earned it. You don't know anything about them, but you're going to go ahead and toss this judgmental stick at them, hoping that you're correct about their skills, whether they're good or not, based on the amount of time they've been training. And that doesn't make any sense. Also, skill is subjective. You might be the best in your city. Does that make you the best in the world? Does that make you the best in your, even in your state? No, that just means you're the best in that area. And so if you're trying to base anything off of skill, that's a very futile thing, because skill is very subjective to the individuals and what you're comparing your skill off of. Because Anderson Silva has been knocked out, does that mean that he's not good? Well, of course not. That's a ridiculous argument. And right. So that's kind of the thing that I'm trying to do with McDojo Life, is instead of people having these ridiculous semantical arguments, oh, they charge too much. Like, to who? If it's too expensive for you, then that's one thing, but it's not too expensive for everybody. And so too much is, again, subjective. But people in the industry will argue about these petty little things, but completely ignore things like the amount of people who get money taken and stolen from them all the time. The amount of people who are getting seriously injured because of unsafe training practices. You know, those are the things that we should be talking about. We shouldn't give a shit too much about those other things. Are they red flags? Sure. Like, that might not be your personal goal, but let's say hypothetically, someone goes to a martial arts studio and their entire goal for themselves is to lose 30 pounds. That's it. They don't care about the belt, even though the belt comes with it, right? And so all of a sudden, they lose 30 pounds and get their black belt. The goal for them was to lose 30 pounds. And by the time they received their black belt, they reached that particular goal. So for them, it did what it was supposed to do. But other people who might be a little bit more argumentative about it, be like, well, they don't know how to fight. The person doesn't care. Like, that person does not care if they know how to fight, nor do they, are they under some impression that they do know how to. The real issue is the fact that they're not doing what they're doing because of the same reason you're doing what you're doing. And so people in the industry love to spit out this nonsensical venom at anybody who doesn't do what they do. They're missing kind of the point of the martial arts, if the only reason they're doing it is just to fight people, you know? And so I think that there's more to it than that. And I think that if we can get everybody on the same page about what is right and wrong in the industry, then maybe we can grow the industry. Maybe there won't be as much infighting. Maybe people will stop that petty nonsensical arguments and help each other.
And it's an interesting perspective on what martial arts should be and what it represents. And if you're on this journey from white to black belt, is it really about being a quote unquote great fighter, or is it about bettering yourself? And what are the different elements that are involved in getting from white to black? And frankly, there are people that get to black belt that don't necessarily represent what it means to be a black belt, and don't encompass, you know, all of these sort of wholesome things that you think are important for being a black belt.
Or even if that's important to them individually, like that's another thing, right? Because that, again, is subjective to the individual's goals, needs, and wants. So if somebody joined the martial arts, and there are plenty of people who join the martial arts, and all they want to do is fight, and they're able to do that, I mean, as long as whatever they're doing in their personal life is not affecting other people in a negative way, there are plenty of people who join martial arts, for lack of better words, who are just dickheads. Is it supposed to make them not dickheads? Well, no. All it's going to do is give them this ability, and then they can do with that what they choose. Some people use it as a conduit to lose weight. Some people use it as a tool to get friends. Some people use it as a way to get a mentor. Some people do it because they want to learn the culture. Some people do it for all kinds of reasons. Mm-hmm. And there are also people who want to just learn how to fight. And there's nothing wrong with that. The problem is that when we project our own bullshit at someone else because they're not doing why we're doing it. Oh, well, he's doing a cardio kickboxing class. It's ridiculous. It's not real kickboxing. You think that person's a moron? Like, of course they know that. And as long as that gym doesn't portray it as something that it's not, then there's no problem. It's a cardio kickboxing class. Who cares? But so many people are like, that's fake. It's not fake. It's just not what you do and why you do it. And so I think that if we can really work on that mentality and fix that, we can kind of fix the martial arts industry as a whole. It should be much bigger than it is. Coaches should not be poor. Coaches should be financially independent enough to be able to continue to do this without having three jobs to have a dojo. But somewhere along the line, people got the impression that making money in the martial arts industry is a bad thing. You're a McDojo if you're financially successful. That is ridiculous. Utterly nonsensical. Like, most McDojos that I've come across are usually the ones that aren't financially successful. They're usually the ones that may have some students here and there, but they may be a part of a bigger organization. So they might reach thousands and thousands of people, but the individual schools aren't made up of hundreds of students. You know, right. But how much is that person's life worth? How much is that person's experience worth?
You mentioned the idea of self-regulation, and there needs to be some regulation, maybe not a sort of any kind of governing body. McDojo Life is one way to do that. Social media perhaps is the way. How do we go about that? Do you think social media, Instagram, Facebook, whatever, is the best way to self-regulate?
I think information is the best. And I think that that's a tool. Social media is a tool, but also making sure that the average person has a better understanding of martial arts in general. Martial arts is extremely convoluted. Like anybody who joins martial arts would be like, which one? There are thousands of them. Like there's like 2,000 different versions of karate. There's like 200 different versions of Indonesian Silat. And each one of those has their own practices, their own standards. Do I bow at the door? Or do I bow at the mat? Do I not bow at all? Is there a picture of the master on the wall? Is there not a picture of master on the wall? Are you sensei? Are you sifu? Are you professor? Are you coach? All of that's very convoluted. And somebody who's not in the martial arts industry would be like somebody who's not a mechanic looking at an engine. They'd look at it and go, I have no clue what's going on here, you know? And so people put a lot of trust into the instructor, because there's not a lot of information that's out there for people to really assimilate, to get a really good look at martial arts from a middle ground, from a position that's not leaning towards their art, but just leaning towards what's right and wrong. And so people, when people ask, which is a question I get all the time, they go, what martial art would be best? Well, that's a broad question. For who? Like, what are your goals? And with all of those things, like, who is it for? What are the goals? What are you trying to achieve? How long do you want to take to achieve it? All of those things are really important to know. Most people will just spit out the answer, which is their art. Like, oh, jiu-jitsu is the best. Like, for who? Like, well, like maybe this person doesn't want jiu-jitsu. Maybe that doesn't help them reach their goals. Or it's like, well, karate is the best. Like, why? Why is that the best for that person? You haven't asked any more details. And so because the industry is so biased, what you really need to do is have general information out there for people to understand that it's more about their individual goals and what they're trying to achieve than it really is about the arts. It's more about the individual instructors, the individual curriculum, the individual organizations, the people who are trying to go achieve whatever goals they're trying to achieve, such as the student. That all of those things are factors. And if you really want to make a difference, it's information. And yes, social media is a tool for that, but you can kind of boil it down to like this campaign that was happening in the 90s and early 2000s. And it was called the Truth Campaign. And it was this big campaign in the United States that was an anti-smoking campaign to spread information to get people to stop smoking. That's all it was. And they would have these grandiose ads on television where there'd be like, you know, 1,000 people standing in Times Square. And then all of a sudden they just all fall down like they died. And then it would be simple, like an ad would, or a little wording would pop up on the screen and say, this amount of people die every day from secondhand smoke. And then that would be it. Like they weren't trying to say, don't do it. They weren't trying to say, hey, they're just giving you facts. Whether or not you do, it's on your own. And so that I think is the best way to do it, because it made such an impact. All they did was spread information. People can make their own decisions after that. People are going to do what they do. But it's better if they're able to do it if you arm them with proper information. That's a real tool that they can use to not fall victim of a fraud, a con artist.
Yeah, in Ireland, there were similar drink driving commercials that sort of shocked people, where two teenagers are crossing the road on their cell phones and you think, oh, it's a cell phone commercial. And one of them gets whacked by a truck and dies. You know, this kind of, you know, similar to what you're describing. But, you know, through your sort of multiple information streams, we're exposed to this never-ending stream of videos and examples of these fake martial arts. But in your mind, like, why do people do it? Like, why on earth would you ever want to fake being a black belt, for example?
Well, take martial arts out of the equation and it becomes much easier to understand. Think about it as a cult or a con, not as a martial arts cult or a martial arts con. And you can see very easily how easy it is to manipulate people. Think about a couple of the things that go on. Just Jim Jones, for example. What people forget is a con, typically with cons like these, is a long con. It's not a short scam. Jim Jones, as an example, when he first started preaching, really preaching, people forget that he was a leader in the civil rights movement. Like, he did a lot of good when he first started. People completely forget about that. They forget that he would take his entire congregation, which was predominantly black, by the way, and go into local restaurants who were white-only restaurants, and that he would convince the restaurant owners, hey, I have 175 people here who are willing to pay you money to eat at your restaurant, and you have no one in this restaurant. Are you really going to turn their money away? And slowly but surely in his town, he converted all of those restaurants into being unsegregated, like allowing people to just go regardless of their color, race, or creed. But then somewhere along the line, Jim Jones goes batshit crazy, starts getting caught on by the FBI. All of a sudden, he starts getting investigated, moves his entire congregation out of the country to another country. They all followed him. Think about how crazy that is for his particular breed of what he was teaching, how crazy that was. But he was a good, charismatic human being. Not a good human being, good at being charismatic. And so when he would take these people there, all of a sudden, next thing you know, it's like senator flying out, trying to make sure everybody is okay. Someone slips the senator a note, needs a little help. Then he guns down the entire party that was with the senator at the airport, and then makes all these people drink this Kool-Aid, and anybody who doesn't gets gunned down, right? It doesn't start at the gunning down of people. No one joins that. It gets to there. And so when you look at a martial arts cult, you think that people are really learning how to knock people out with their mind on their first day? No, they're learning everything that we all learned on our first day. It has to be built up. When you first go into a trial class, you're going to learn the same no matter where you go. You're either going to learn a punch, a kick, a block, a takedown, or a defense against a takedown. You might learn how to break ball. You might learn how to stand in base. That's about it. Maybe a submission, right? Those are what you're going to pick from on your first day. You're not going to learn anything more advanced than that, no matter where you are, right? We're not going to do flying triangles on your first day of class, I hope. If you're out there doing that, stop. All right? And so, like, it has to build up. Trust has to be made. And in the martial arts, we have this thing that's very strange where we already put a lot of stake into the other person and a lot of trust into the person when we first walk in. First of all, I have to submit to you as soon as I walk in there because I have to admit to myself one thing. You know more about this subject than I do. So I have to automatically put you ahead of me. I have to, in order for me to learn from you. I have to say, at least he's better at this or she's better at this. Then the next step is I have all those already natural things that are in the martial arts industry that may or may not be true. When you walk into a dojo, you automatically expect discipline and respect and honor and integrity and all of these catchwords that have been circulating in the martial arts industry forever. Like, we don't put that on a pedestal for any other industry. You'd never go to your mechanic and be like, he's a great mechanic. Why is he good? Because he beat the shit out of like five dudes. Like, no one would care. They'd be like, okay, but my car isn't running still. Like, fix the problem. But we put this on a pedestal for some reason in our minds that it's some kind of holier than thou position to be a professor or a sifu or a sensei or, you know, like, they're just people. They have a skill. I'm paying you for a skill. And so people want to make it more than it really is. And once you start doing that, it becomes really culty and it becomes really scary because at that moment, when you put these people on such a high pedestal, you're allowing them a lot more control over you than they really should. And that's scary. So try not to think about it as a martial arts issue. It's just an issue. You can have a cult of personality, a cult of money. You can have a cult of politics, which we see that a lot nowadays. People who are just like, have known someone for 30 years, and because they voted for someone different, just because of that, they'll be like, I can't talk to you anymore. Like, how fucking culty is that? You know, like, but we want to think that these things aren't happening all the time. They are everywhere. The only difference really here than there is that in martial arts, it's so much easier to get away with it because it's so easy to manipulate people into it. You're already giving me all this power over you when you first walk in the door that you wouldn't give to anyone else.
Can you think of any examples, ones that stand out, these black belts or martial artists that are particularly interesting or particularly goofy or particularly, you know, that just sort of stand out from the rest of the herd?
Oh, yeah, there's tons of them. Like, I'll give you a couple examples. One, there's a guy who started his own system and calls it better than Krav Maga, even though it is just Krav Maga. He shot a student doing gun disarms with live ammunition.
Oh, my gosh.
So, like, yeah, exactly. That would be most people's response. His students don't seem to care. Like, oh, it was an accident. No, that's not an accident. That's called negligence. The difference is an accident is, oh, this gun is clear. There's nothing in the chamber. And then all of a sudden, boom, it goes off. Like, okay, well, I did everything I needed to do safety-wise. But he literally started doing that, gun disarms with live ammunition, which you can see again on our YouTube channel. Then you figured maybe the guy learned his lesson. Nope. Clearly, after he shot a student, he's still doing gun disarms with live ammunition. So he's eventually going to kill or shoot another person if he hasn't already, that I just don't know about. The guy also went around and set up seminars all around the world. All the seminars, he required everyone to pay in advance. Several of those seminars, he never showed up to. When people asked for refunds, he refused. Now, where I come from, that's a definition of fraud. You said you were going to provide a service or a product, had people pay for it, you didn't provide that service or product, now committed fraud. That's like one person. That's one. I cover thousands of these people. Almost every day, someone new. How about the term créanche? Have you ever heard the term créanche?
Créanche, yeah.
Créanche, which means trader. And it's almost always used for someone who just simply goes and trains at another gym. Would you like think about, apply that to anything else that you would do? Apply that to Walmart, right? I go to Walmart and I go up and then the manager's standing there. And he's like, hey, why you go to Publix? I see you post picture. You say you go to Publix. Why you not go to Walmart? And I'm like, well, because I just went there one day. Why does that matter? You trader, you never come back to Walmart. You never, you crunch. But in jujitsu, people try to justify that as a legit thing. If you go to a religious sermon or whatever that particular thing may call it, the goal of the religious leader should be to provide you with the religious information to save your soul, basically, right? To give right. you a better ethics or morals or whatever it is that they're providing you. They're providing you with religious information. And most of the time, they're not getting much in return because it's not about them. It's about helping you. Same thing with martial arts. Martial arts instructor is there to teach you martial arts. If it's all about the instructor and it's not about the student, that means that the instructor's ego is hurt because you decided that somebody else might have more information or better information or just simply different information than your instructor. And his ego couldn't take it. So rather than just saying, you know what, it hurt my feelings that you went somewhere else. Was there something we weren't providing you? Could we do something better? Understanding that owning a business is about taking responsibility for your own actions. Rather than that, they go, it's your fault. You messed up. It's your fault. And make you feel bad. Like, here's how it should be. You're providing a service. I'm giving you money for the service. When I leave these doors, that's it. That's it. That's my obligation. My obligation was to pay you money on time and show up. Your obligation, teach me martial arts. Past that, everything else is supplemental. If I choose to get more out of it, I can. If I don't want to get more out of it, I don't have to. There is no mysticism to any of this. And so people want to make it this crazy mystical thing. It's just paying for a service and you're learning a skill.
What do you say to, at least in some cases, not every case, people that sort of push back and say, this is no, you know, my fake martial art or whatever, they're not going to say fake martial art, my martial art is no different from Dungeons and Dragons or dressing up for Star Trek convention. What do you say to people that go that direction?
If that's what they believe, that's fine. It's not my job to change their mentality. Mm-hmm. Like all I'm doing is providing information. If I prove to them, which again, you have to remember that people don't typically change their mind about beliefs. Like core beliefs don't really change. They have to make their own decision. And I heard this done really well. Joe Rogan recently had a guest on his show. It was like last week, who was a gentleman who spent almost his entire life like getting people who were Klansmen to leave the Klan. And he's a black dude. And so he would have these conversations. And the way that he put it was probably better than I could put it. Is you can't change someone's reality. You can only change their perception because someone's perception is their reality. For instance, if you told me like, this is blue or, you know, these are the rules to Monopoly, right? I could sit there and say, that's not the rules to Monopoly. That's ridiculous. Monopoly does not have those rules. You made that up. Now we're going to butt heads. But if I pull out a rule book and I show you the rules and I say, hey, I just want to kind of show you like, that may be how you play, but the rule book says this. Then I can change your perception. You go, oh, you know what? Maybe I just remembered it wrong. Or maybe, you know what? You're right, but I prefer to play it this way. So all you can really do is give information. It's not my job to change people. So like I get it all the time where people are like, that person's legit. You shouldn't be calling them out. By the way, the guy who was ripping people off, the guy who shot a student, the guy who got kicked off a gun range for illegal use of a firearm, the guy who was setting up challenge matches and lied about his resume. He did all of these things and I have definitive proof. And he still has people believing that the things I said was not real, even though he himself admitted to all of those things. And they still wanted to believe what they wanted to believe. They're going to do that. My job isn't to try to pull those people out of those cults. They're already in. They're in there. They're not going to leave. What I hope to do is by giving information, I make people think before they join anything. Think, what am I getting myself into? Think how much I'm paying. Think, is this abuse? Think about those things on their own, and then they can make their own decisions.
Are you ever concerned that you might, one of these nut bars might come around and pay you a visit or open yourself up to some kind of, you know, liability litigation, whatever, through doing all of this?
Like, don't care. Like, but I've had death threats all the time. Like, what are you going to do? You're going to make me a martyr? Thank you. You're going to prove my point. Like, okay, you shot me. All right. I'm strapped. I live in Florida. So like, I live the thug life. I got my Glock right here. I got my body armor in my backpack, which I always carry with me. So I'm not concerned. If it happens, it happens, but that's not going to stop me from doing what I do. The fear of doing something right is a problem. If you're terrified to do the right thing, you need to think about yourself internally and like what your priorities are. If somebody is like, well, I can't do the right thing because I'm scared of the consequences. And I'm not the ethics boss. I fuck up. I make mistakes, and I've done all kinds of horrible shit, I'm sure, that people don't like. I make mistakes just like anybody else. But that's not going to stop me from wanting to do the right thing when I have the opportunity. The opposite of good is not evil. It's indifference. It's people seeing bad shit and going, meh, nothing I can do about it.
People, you've had death threats.
Yeah. So my first death threat was actually in London. I got hired to do a nunchuck seminar out there, of all things. And so I got hired and I was like, well, I'm going to be out here. So I'll just stay for 2 weeks. Like, the plane ride's brutal. So I was like, I'm not just going to go and come back. So right. I'm out there for 2 weeks. I taught my seminar. And then the last weekend I was there, the Taekwondo school that I was teaching at, they said, hey, we have a Taekwondo tournament. Would you come and, you know, watch the tournament and support our team? I was like, of course. And so I went and I'm sitting on the bleachers and I'm messing around answering my direct messages. And then out of nowhere, I get a direct message from an account that had no followers, no posts, and they weren't following anyone. It was just a blank account. And all they wrote was what I was wearing. And I was like, that's weird. And there were thousands of people in this gymnasium. I mean, it was a humongous gym with thousands of people in it. And I was like, okay, well, that's a little concerning and weird, but let's talk to the person. Because it happens sometimes, like people will be like too shy to come talk to you. And so I always let them know, you're just a regular dude, man. You can just come say, hey. So I said, come over and say, hey, we can talk or whatever you want. And then they went on to describe something that I had done when I first started on my Facebook. And that was concerning to me. It was about a martial arts instructor who was a convicted pedophile who had changed his name and opened up a school in the United States. And so I got sent that information years ago on my Facebook before it got shut down. And then I wound up like kind of writing a report about that guy. And all the people who were following me at the time went to his pages and started giving him negative reviews. So he winds up shutting down his school somewhere in there and moves overseas. He opens up another school overseas in London. When he does this, he changes his name again, changes his appearance slightly, and starts opening up another school. So when he does this, again, he hadn't been caught yet. And so somebody later on, a few years later, had sent me a message on Facebook again. Hey, isn't this that guy that you had called out years ago? He looks very familiar. Come to find out, it's the same guy. Yeah. So I was like, all right, write another thing. And again, his school closed down. The person who had written me was a student of his, or at least that's what they were saying in their message. And they said that I had wrongly accused him of this stuff and that I ruined that guy's life and that he was a good man and did nothing but help his community. Like, dude, like, I have the evidence right there. Like, it wasn't like I made it up. Like, you can see that he was like convicted. Like, this wasn't made up. Right. And so the guy told me, which, by the way, this was in London, so I took this with a grain of salt, but still a little scary because I didn't know who it was. They could have been anybody in the audience. And they said when I left the tournament, they were going to shoot me. And like I said, grain of salt, this is London. Chances are good they don't have a gun. But then I thought about it. I was like, I could have probably gotten a gun out here. Like, I really thought about it. I was like, it probably wouldn't be as hard. So I thought about it, and I was like, all right, well, this is a little much. So I went down. Talked to some police officers that were off-duty police officers just helping out with the tournament. And I told them about it. They were like, yeah, there's not really much we can do, but what we can do is we can like walk you out to your car. So whenever this is done, we'll walk you out to your car. Nothing ever came of it, but that was like the first death threat where I was fairly concerned because the person was there. I would have never known who it was. There was all these people. And I got this threat that was directly related to something that I had done. And so from then on, I started changing a little bit about how I do things and try to be a little bit more tight-lipped about my personal life and things like that. Like, it just affects me. I don't care. Like, I'll let people know if I'm going to this place or this tournament or this state. Cool. Because that'll just affect me. you know, but like, I don't want to bring that drama into any schools that I train at or anything like that, because that's not their fault.
Sure. So
I try to keep things a little bit more tight to the chest now.
So you travel carefully, I guess, now and make sure to sort of watch your six, as they say.
I mean, it is what it is. Like, there's plenty of people that don't like me, and there's plenty of people that really hate what I do, and that's okay. They're more than welcome to that opinion, you know. But also, I have this weird thing where people online think that I'm like a little guy. I don't know why, but like, I'm 6'1", 200-pound guy. Like, I'm not a small man.
I guess in that same vein, when you visit other gyms or when you travel like that, are people expecting, you know, Bruce Lee? Are they expecting this incredible martial artist? Not that you're not. I mean,
I'm mediocre. Like, I'm trying to be honest. Like, I'm a pretty good kickboxer, because that's what I spent the most of my career doing. I was on an international kickboxing team at one point in NASCA, which was point fighting. But I was ranked number 4 in the world at one point in time. And so, like, I was above average at kickboxing. My jiu-jitsu, super mediocre. Like, any game, like, purple belt who, like, trains, like, a couple times a week is probably going to submit me. Like, I'm not doing this for the same reason they're doing this. The thing I hate about it is people kind of expect a certain something from you when you do what I do.
Right.
And it's weird because I'll go to a gym just to train. And when I go just to train, they're like, are you here to call us out? You calling us a fraud? Like, no, you see a camera? I was like, I'm just stopping in for a class.
I want to ask you, you know, there's a lot of martial arts out there that get a bad rap, whether it's true or not. Aikido is sometimes the butt of jokes. Taekwondo, there are certain gyms out there that the whole family can get black belts together. Obviously, there are plenty of UFC fighters, Stephen Thompson, like these different guys that prove some of these martial arts that are made fun of are legitimate. What are your thoughts there?
I think that typically the art, typically, I'm not going to say 100% of the time, maybe I'll say 90% of the time, the art is never the issue. It's the individuals, the practitioners. Mm-hmm. And so, again, going back to what I said earlier in the podcast, people's individual goals are more important than people's ego. If I look at an art like Aikido, for instance, I can say without a doubt that that's not primarily an art for self-defense. It's an art that will help you understand culture, because there's a lot of culture that goes into that art, a lot of traditionalism. Like, most of the time they wear hakamas and things like that. There's a lot of like wrist locks. So that would be maybe the 10% that actually does have some weight, because a lot of guys, if you mix wrist locks and jiu-jitsu, I can isolate the arm and get a good wrist lock. Maybe not get a standing one, which is fairly difficult to do, but I can actually apply some of that. But what if the person's goal wasn't to learn self-defense? And I know that that's strange, but you have to remember that martial arts and self-defense don't necessarily go together. For instance, wushu. Like, a lot of people like wushu because it's a very pretty art to look at, you know? And so they might be doing it because they like the theatrical reason for doing it. Taekwondo is kind of a mix. There are certain Taekwondo artists, like, let's say, Anthony Pettis, for instance, who was able to use Taekwondo, his black belt base, as a way to be able to use that in actual combat. Raymond Daniels is another example. A sport karate guy, Stephen Thompson. GSP is a Kyokushin karate black belt. Michael Venom Page, sport karate guy. So the list goes on and on with martial artists who have a karate or Taekwondo base. Some people do Taekwondo because they want to be a stunt actor. They don't care about self-defense as much. They care about going on to Hollywood, becoming famous, and becoming an actor. Like, for instance, if you look at somebody like a Scott Atkins. Scott Atkins is in great shape, and he probably could fight you pretty well. But that's not his primary reason for doing it. He wanted to become an actor. He learned these things so that way he could portray that on stage, on theater. You know. Right. So does that mean that he's not a good martial artist? No. His reasoning for doing it is just different than your reasoning for doing it. Look at Taylor Lautner. Taylor Lautner was a sport karate kid. He had his black belt at an extremely young age. And when I was doing the NASCA circuit back in the day, I would see him on the side of the ring doing his homework before he would compete. He'd do bo staff at the time. He would do his bo staff routine or his kama routine. And then he would go back to doing his homework. And he was a multiple time world champion by the time he became an adult. Would you be able to beat child Taylor Lautner up? Yes. Could Taylor Lautner now probably buy you and sell you because of the amount of money he's made through movies and TV? Yes. Like, the reasoning he did it. So, and it always amuses me, by the way, because then you have people who are like, oh, that's Kata's, that's weak. Like, who does that? That's ridiculous. Meanwhile, you're broke and you have like 20 and 0 fights. Congratulations. You're a 20 and 0 amateur. Good job. This teenage child, Taylor Lautner, who you could kick his ass, doesn't care because he's living in a mansion because he thought outside the box with his martial art. But you keep that 20 and 0 amateur record. Good for you. Like people need to feel good about themselves. And sometimes they do that by putting others down because they do shit that's different. If that's what you do in the martial arts and that's all you got out of it, I feel bad for you.
From a self-defense perspective, and by the way, I agree 100% with what you're saying. Martial arts isn't just about trying to beat people up. There is a whole other realm, even excluding the sport aspect of it, just for making you a better person. You know, I'm a big believer in that. From a self-defense perspective, when you think of this classic schoolyard, okay, conjures ideas of two kids bashing on each other, what do you think is the most practical, pragmatic combination of arts? Now, you know, of course, people today would say, well, mixed martial arts is maybe the, one of the better ones to sort of go because it's a mix of different, multiple different disciplines. But if you had to sort of, if you were advising somebody today, okay, I just want to learn self-defense, I have no interest in sports or these other reasons for doing martial arts, what would your advice be?
I would have to look at the individual. Let's say the person has a disability where they only have one arm, only one leg, no legs, can't walk, only have the use of their body from the waist up, they can't move their arms or have no arms. Like I said earlier, I don't think things can be pigeonholed as easy and as clean as we really want them to be because the individual matters so much. Dan Inosanto, who is a legend in the martial arts industry, if nobody knows who that is, you should look him up. But Dan Inosanto said that martial arts is made up of attributes. And so we want to think that technique is the end all be all. And it does have something to do with it, don't get me wrong, but that's only a one slice of the pie. Size, height, weight, aggression, reach, temperament, the ability to be calm under pressure. How do you handle adrenaline? All of those things matter too. So you might get somebody who's a white belt in BJJ, who's been doing it for a year, who most of the time on the mat might do fairly well, put them on the street and they've never had to handle a situation in real life. And then they lose all of that because they don't know how to handle aggression well. They don't know how to handle their adrenaline well, and they've never been put in a position where they had to actually use it. So there's more to it than just the art. There's a lot that has to do with the individual. And I think the more individuals learn that, the less ego will probably be in the industry. You know, people will always say, you always hear the thing about posturing. Like in the animal kingdom, when an animal is terrified of you, it will get bigger. Like a bear will stand up on its hind legs and try to intimidate you. A snake will come up or rattle its tail. All kinds of animals do this. Humans are no different. What does a human do when he's scared? He gets louder and gets taller. Why do you think people bump chests? They're trying to intimidate you. Oh yeah, get taller, stick that chest out, get louder. They're scared. Like they're terrified. They don't know how to handle that adrenaline. Meanwhile, people are usually scared of the fucking quiet guy. Ryan Hall was a great example of this, by the way, because there's a video of Ryan Hall having dinner with his family at some Italian restaurant. Some guy comes in. He's being belligerent at the table, standing, yelling into his face. Calm as a cucumber. Hey, man, I think you should leave. This isn't what you want to do. He doesn't, no bravado, no anger. It wasn't technique and jujitsu that allowed him to do that. That wasn't what allowed him to do that. The fact that he had put himself under pressure so many times, he was able to de-escalate the situation because he wasn't concerned because it wasn't going to be worse than training. You know, he's like, well, this guy is about my size. At least he's not 200 pounds heavier than me. He's angry. His hands are down. He can analyze it, right? But you could do that with a lot of different martial arts. You know, if you put yourself in the pressure cooker under fire, you'd be able to handle that situation the same. Now, at the end of the day, how he finished that situation was he double-legged the guy and put him on the ground and mounted him. Right. So at that point, sweet. But it's not always going to be that simple and easy. You know, Gary Tonin, and I'm not downing Gary Tonin whatsoever, but he attempted a leg lock in his last fight and he did get knocked out. Like, does that mean that jiu-jitsu leg locks don't work? No. Does that mean that striking is better than jiu-jitsu? No. Does that mean jiu-jitsu is better than striking? Well, clearly not at that moment, you know, but like all of these things are just factors and there's more than just art that goes into it. So if someone were to ask me what art do I think that they should do for self-defense? I would say the one you practice the most, the one that you go to the gym and actually put the work in. Because if you go to jiu-jitsu once a year and you say, I train jiu-jitsu, well, what good is that going to do you? Like, I took a jiu-jitsu class, so I trained jiu-jitsu. No, you don't. Like, you take a class, you know?
How did you get into jiu-jitsu yourself? Are you in Gracie Baja, is it, or where?
I train in a lot of different places now, but my primary instructor, I actually ran into him when I was walking to go teach an after-school program. So I owned a martial arts school for 4 years. And my primary way of teaching was I go to after-school programs, I go to places, and then I teach on site. And so it was actually a great way to be lucrative. And I provided classes that were supplementary outside of the on-site classes. Like, for instance, we couldn't spar on site at those facilities, but I had another facility I was renting out, and people could come to me on like Thursdays and Tuesdays to spar. And so as I was walking to this private school, he was walking past me in a rash guard and jiu-jitsu gi pants. And I was walking up in a karate t-shirt and karate pants. And we just happened to be passing each other. And I was like, hey, and we started a conversation. And he was like, yeah, my kids go here and stuff like that. And he told me that he was breaking away from the affiliation that he was a part of. And he was going to be starting at another one. He was going to start his own school. And I was like, man, I'd really like to learn jiu-jitsu. And I always wanted 10 black belts before I die, which is still an ultimate goal of mine. And I was like, jiu-jitsu is probably going to take me 10 to 15 years, just to be honest. I was like, probably take me 10 to 15 years to get a black belt reasonably. So I was like, I already have two other black belts. Let's go and do this one now while I'm young enough and healthy enough to put my body through what jiu-jitsu is going to require of me. And then maybe do other arts later on down the road. But this will be the hardest one. And so I went ahead and just started after that. Built a good relationship with him. Loved the gym. You know, his mentor at the time was a huge dick. Still is. And then he eventually broke away from him, thank God. But that kind of gave me a little bit of a firsthand glimpse, really, at like cult-like behavior. You know, based off of the gold standard of how long it takes you to get a black belt in jiu-jitsu, it is the toughest. Like, it does take you the longest. It will take you forever to get a black belt. Unless you have like this phenomenal talent and understanding and drive, it's going to take you a while to get a black belt in jiu-jitsu. I know purple belts who've been at it for 20-something years. So it's not one of those arts that you can just show up and eventually get a black belt in. You have to prove yourself in this art. And you have to consistently do it. You can't just show up every once in a while and expect to get promoted. And there are other arts where they allow you to do that. And that's not a standard I wanted to set for myself. And that's not a standard I would ever accept for myself, is just show up to get it. I want to earn it. And I want to earn that through the time and dedication it takes to understand the art. I think that's what makes or breaks a black belt, is really understanding the art. Your skill level is going to be different no matter who you are. But understanding the art and having the ability to explain it to someone and them learn the art, I think is really the primary example of, to me, the best way to look at a black belt. You know, because people will always set the standard as skill, which is a stupid standard, because there will always be someone better than you. So that can't be the standard, because if it was, there'd only be one black belt ever. The guy who always wins. Gordon Ryan, right. Like the only fucking black belt in the history. Everybody else, you're a brown belt until you can beat them, right? But then what happens if you are skilled and something happens to you? Like, let's say you get into a car accident and you're no longer able to move your body the way you were before. Does that mean you're no longer a black belt? These are questions that most people don't ever ask or talk to themselves about to try to understand what a black belt means. They think it's all skill.
Coaching is, coaching kids, for example, or, you know, fundamentals, whatever, is one of the best ways to learn, because you need to know, you know, the six steps of the triangle, whatever it is, to be able to teach it.
For sure. When I started teaching, I started getting better at whatever art it was I was teaching, you know, because you have to like really break it down and to the fundamentals and understand, okay, how do I explain this to a room full of people who will all think about this a different way? This guy over here would work with the golf analogy, but this guy over here doesn't golf. So he had no clue what I'd say if I said, do this like you would for golf. And so having to break that down to the most simple, basic way of communicating that to people allows you in your head to go, well, how do I do that? Like, sometimes you do stuff and you're like, I just do it. But then you can't just say that when you're teaching a class. So you have to break it down. You have to become a good instructor, which makes you better.
Right. I remember that myself. I remember, you know, our professor saying, hey, you know, go show such and such move, and having to do it. And even now today, I sort of encourage beginners to adults, you know, to come to the kids classes for that very reason, not necessarily because they're sort of coaching, but they're learning how to teach and then and sort of going through that process themselves while teaching, kind of thing.
Yeah. And if you want to be good, get good at teaching kids.
Right.
Adults will learn. They'll figure it out. I promise. Right. Kids, on the other hand, they have to have a skill when it comes to teaching kids.
Right. So Rob, you've got your fingers in a few different pies at this point in your life. The McDojo life, motion picture under production, a few other ventures. So what's on the hopper with you?
I mean, right now, the biggest thing is trying to get that documentary, because we already filmed at the first 3 months of last year. We had all the hiccups you could possibly have that were unexpected. Like, just to give people a timeline, when we first had the idea, me and my crew, I had to shop for a crew. So like when I was first like, I'm going to make a documentary about this stuff, I asked around to different people in the industry who might be willing to help me do it. And I wound up getting a crew. That took me 3 months. Like that's not an easy process to like find the right fit. So after that first 3 months, then we had to come up with an idea and a plan for crowdfunding. That took us another 3 months. So now we're already half a year in from conception. And so, okay, well, now we have the idea. Now we need to implement the crowdfunding. So we did that. That was another 3 months, because 90 days was all that we were allowed to crowdfund on this particular platform that we did it on. So now we're already at 9 months. And then we were like, all right, well, we have to find dates and times that'll work for filming now that we were able to reach a financial amount that we could work with, which was not even close to what we were asking for. I had to pull tons of money out of my own pocket. Wow. So then that was another 3-4 months out. Then when about a month before I'm getting ready to go to California to basically live there for 3 months while we're filming, COVID hit. And so it was like everything was shut down. Like all these lockdowns happened. Gyms were closing. Like gyms weren't even allowed to be legally open. And it's like, well, how do we do a martial arts documentary without going into any martial arts schools? And so we were like, all right, well, we got to wait. So by the time we actually got to really filming, that was another year because of COVID. Like we're going to have to work around this because we don't know if it will ever ease up. Then we filmed. That was 3 months. And so now we're almost 2.5 years in by this time, by the time we're done. And then so it's like, all right, cool. Well, now that we're here and we've already got it done, how do we get it bought? We don't know. We've never done this before. This is our first go. So it was like, all right, cool. Well, let's figure out how to get it bought. And so we started like shopping it around, but then we were like, well, we don't have enough. We started to realize that we needed a pitch deck. We started to realize that we needed a lot of things we didn't have. And then we were like, well, maybe we should independently do it. So we started editing it on our own. And then as we're editing on our own, a friend of mine, his name's Jonathan Sadowski, and he's a producer. He did a movie called 8-Bit Christmas. He's an actor on that show Sex Life on Netflix. And he's a jiu-jitsu guy. And so I hit him up and I was like, dude, we're just having a hard time understanding. We got navigating this industry. He's like, I got a guy for you. I'll go ahead and have a meeting with him and see if it's a project he's willing to get on. He's an Emmy award-winning editor. He already has 2 documentaries out on his own. We loved his stuff. So we brought him on. And ever since we brought him on, we've just been kicking doors open forward. And so now we're in the progress of, okay, well, we wanted to sell it, but the agency, UTA, United Talent Agency, who we're in talks with right now, they were like, you actually could just make a better movie. They were like, what if instead of selling it as is, we got you an extra $800,000 to do reshoots? They're like, it's fucking great. Like, we could make the movie the way we want to make it, like really make it. And so that's where we're at right now. But the process was not easy and it is a nightmare, but like I'm very persistent human being, no matter what, I already said it was going to come out. So it's going to come out. We already have enough footage to make a film right now as it is, but we want to make it better. That's all there is to it. We just want to make it so that way people are like, holy shit, you like met those people in person? Like, cause that's what's going to happen. Like during our filming, a lot of the stuff had to be via Skype because of COVID. And so we got to interview some of the biggest frauds in the industry. When you see the, because I can't say now because we have to probably reshoot with them. But when you see the level of frauds that we actually got, you're going to be like, oh, my God. Like you got like the dream team of martial arts frauds all on camera. And we did experiments. Like I taught a seminar where I completely made up a martial art, completely made up my martial arts background, taught complete nonsense for an hour just to see if people would buy it. They all bought it, hook, line, and sinker. And then I taught them a real seminar afterwards, like rear naked choke, like basic stuff that actually works. And then we actually hired a fraud to come in and teach us a seminar. And I filled the classroom full of 15 people who all trained from different martial arts. And we just kind of let him know that none of them really trained. And so he just taught us like complete garbage for the first hour. And then for the second hour, I told them to be themselves. And then, man, like gold, pure gold on film, because that guy went from being bone dry to profusely sweating, nervous because of the things people were asking.
I mean, if that doesn't, if you're listening to this podcast and that doesn't whet your appetite to see this, so you currently you're not sure when it's coming out.
We'll know in a week or two. So right now, the next meeting we have with UTA should be the green light meeting. Okay. We've already had two meetings with them. And the meetings that we had were very good. They did ask us to tighten up a couple things that we needed on our end in terms of paperwork. So we got all that tightened up. And that my guy who handles that is back on the 19th. So when he comes in on the 19th, he's going to let me know how long it's going to take for him to tighten up the rest of what needs to be done. And then once that happens, we have our meeting. And then once that happens, I will make a public announcement on all fronts that we, everything that's happened, everything that's going on. And hopefully we can get people pumped up again, because I know people had to wait. But I will say this. I'm so fortunate that the people who had faith in this project still have faith in this project, even though it's taking so long. Most people understood that we had to work through COVID, or we had to do delays. Sure. Because of COVID. There are douchebags online who don't understand that COVID was a thing. Like, they're like, hey, what happened to that scam of a documentary? You actually donated to the page. You would have access to a page called McDojo Life DOC on Instagram. And if you donated, you would have all the information you want. All the updates are there. And so everyone who donated has access to that. The people who didn't donate are the only ones who are bitching and moaning. The people who actually put in money for the project are still backing the project, because we keep them updated. We tell them what's going on. So it's like, baffles me how entitled some people are, because they're not doing it. Oh, I would have gotten this done already. Because if you would, you would have already made it. Like, why do you need all this money? You know, like, why don't you do it on your cell phone? Yeah, I want a movie to look like dog shit. Yeah, that's smart. Like, why do you, don't need money? Yeah, I don't need to eat. I don't need to. You're correct. I don't need to eat this entire time. Oh, like, oh, we travel. So I don't need to, how do I do that? I walk. I'm going to take my bike to like Japan, you jackass. Like, get out of here. It's amazing what kind of people shit say online. And it's like, ah, God, if I could slap you with my butt cheek, I would.
And you are writing a book as well.
Yeah. So we're trying to make it so that way that book comes out around the time the documentary comes up. But when I was a kid, I actually started full contact fighting at 15. My first match, like in point fighting, which it's not full contact, was a month after I started training. But I started doing smoker fights at 15 at a nightclub that was 21 and up. And the experiences that I had in that nightclub were absolutely crazy. My instructor set himself on fire in that nightclub. We did 2-on-2 fights, 3-on-3 fights, 1-on-3 fights. The first fight I ever had, I was 15. I fought a guy who was like 35 years old. And then we actually have all of that filmed. So I'm taking all these now, and I'm trying to basically tell the stories that I had from those fight nights in this book, and about me growing up as a kid and being in these smoker fights.
So will you link that to YouTube, or we'll be able to see that footage?
Yeah, some of it's already up. Like, if you go to my YouTube, there's a 2-on-2 fight that I did, where I'm just getting wrecked. We wind up winning just because I have a hard head and I had good cardio. But like, so the story behind it, if anybody actually like goes to our YouTube to check it out, it says Rob 2-on-2 fight or something like that. And I'll release more of this footage as time goes on, but I wanted to save some of it for the documentary. It's all on film. You can just go watch it on our YouTube channel. You can watch me get kind of beat up, but my cardio prevailed. So
all on film, all watchable, and just absolute insanity.
Yeah, man, and I got to tell you, man, I learned so much, because I was a kid, I was a child fighting adults, but I was also going through an adult. That was my teenage years. That was, you know, some of the most impressionable years. So the people that I was learning life from were drunks in a bar. Like, it was a unique experience.
Well, Rob, I know we could go on and on and on forever, indefinitely here, but I know you're busy and you've got other things to do. The next time you're in Salt Lake, swing by our gym, message me, and you know, we'll get to spend some time on the mat together. This has just been awesome, and some like real gems of information in this podcast. I'm definitely going to enjoy listening back to this one. Rob, thanks again for your time.
Yeah, man. Thank you for having me on. Love talking shop. Do it anytime.